Hello, we're in Fresno. I'm talking to Philip Walker. It's July 20th, 1997. Hi, we always start off these discussions with some basic questions. For example, when were you born?
Well, I was born January 10th, 1939.
And you don't have to even look at the...
Oh, I don't have to look
at it. It's very sensitive. Okay. Well, we'll check it for volume in a second. But you were born in...
Pomona. Southern California.
On
January 10th,
1939. 1939. Yeah. And what did your parents do when you were growing up?
Well, they were teachers then. Mm-hmm. They were both school teachers. My dad was a music teacher in the high school, and my mother was an elementary teacher. And then later on, my dad went into other areas having to do with church executive work and social work connected with a program called the National Conference of Christians and Jews.
And your father was a member of the Church of the Brethren.
Right.
And your family,
comes from the Church of the Brethren.
Very active.
And way back.
Yeah,
both of our families come back. Way back in the Church of the Brethren.
Of course, I interviewed your wife, so I know a lot of the answers to a lot of these questions, so don't be surprised if I don't follow them up.
Okay.
Did you have any commitment to travel or international service independent from your Brethren experience?
Oh, we did. We were interested in overseas types of travel and had a sense that we wanted to go overseas. When we were in BVS, before we connected with IVS, we had some friends that we knew that had been in Europe, and we thought, gee, that'd be fun. Maybe we could teach school in Europe.
Good answer. What I was thinking about was before you went to college.
Yeah. Oh, before I went to college? No, I don't think so. Not before college.
And why did you choose Laverne College of all places to go to?
There wasn't any other college in existence.
As far as you were concerned.
Yeah, that was where my parents both graduated. In fact, I was fourth generation at Laverne College.
Fourth generation Laverne.
Yeah, I was fourth generation. So there really wasn't, I didn't have any interest in going to any place. My family and friends, all the kids I went to camp with when I was a kid were all going to Laverne, and so that was where I was going to go to.
Okay, let's do it. Did you have any interest in choir, for example, before you went to college?
Yeah, I was singing in a chorus in high school, and then I sang in my dad's church choir when I was a kid in junior high, so I started way back.
But you were just preparing to meet Catherine in the choir.
Not necessarily. No, that wasn't in the plan then.
It just happened. And Catherine mentioned that when you got married, you altered your vows so that it would incorporate a commitment to service.
Yeah, we kind of created our own. My dad was a minister, and so he married us, but we kind of created some of our own words that we wanted to use as part of that, in addition to what he came up with.
What did you say?
Oh, I don't even remember.
Uh-huh. You don't even remember?
No, I don't remember what it was. It had something to do with service and doing something beyond just meeting our own personal self-interest, that sort of thing.
But you graduated with was it a B.S. in education?
It was a B.A. in education / sociology.
Hmm. And what happened after that?
Well, taught fourth grade for 1 year. That was in 61, 62. And then during that year, I got the notice from the draft board that I was going to be drafted. So
this was in 1960?
This was in 61. And when I was 18, I had signed some forms through the Church of the Brethren indicating that I wanted to relate to the conscientious objector status, and so I had signed some papers indicating that that's where I preferred to focus. And then when I had my notice to take the armed services physical, I wrote to the draft board and said that I have on record that I want to serve as a non-combatant in some sort of capacity. So they wrote a letter back saying that would be okay. I guess they did whatever research they did. They didn't give me a real hard time. And they wrote me back and gave me the alternatives of what I could do for alternative service. So again, being connected with a lot of the church people, the director of the Brethren Voluntary Service Program in New Windsor, Maryland, called him long distance and said, "Hey, Rodney, I'm going to be drafted. I need to get some direction here. Can you tell me on the phone that you could accept me into IVF or into BVS?" Mm-hmm. And of course, we knew it probably because he knew our family. And mm-hmm. So he said, "Yeah, I think we can work that out okay. These are the dates that the orientations are starting," mm-hmm. some thought and so forth. And so without much decision making, we knew that's what we were going to do. We knew BVS. some new friends that had been in BBS, and so that's where we wanted to go. And we knew that in doing so, that would lead to my alternative service without having to go in the military. Mm-hmm. Well, I went through the military armed services physical, mm-hmm. But that was about it. And then in October of 62, we went up to her folks, Wenatchee, and met her cousin and his wife, who was also going to be this with us, and we took a train together from Wenatchee to Baltimore and then on to New Windsor. Mm-hmm.
And you did the training, you did the BBS training in New Windsor, and then?
That was almost, well, that was from October. It was supposed to be finished in October, November, December. Yeah, but after we were there, we found that the types of projects that were being set up for us weren't exactly what we wanted. We wanted to go into teaching, and so we began to ask around and found out about IDS. And then we went to Washington, D.C. for some interviews, and in the process there, they gave us jobs typing for IBS, some of the resumes of some of the applicants, mm-hmm. and in the process then was accepted for IBS. So then it was in March then that we went to Vietnam.
So you were involved in IBS principally because you could get a teaching assignment?
Because we wanted to stay in our professions. Mm-hmm. BBS didn't have anything that was really professional level.
Uh-huh. At the time, you probably you knew that IBS was actually operating under contract to USAID. Did it have any resonance for you that you were actually, you had a background clearance from USAID, that you were kind of working for the federal government in some capacity?
Or? Oh, I did, but it was kind of exciting. It was, uh-huh. it was venturous, and uh-huh. we were young, and uh-huh. we had some sense of what that was about, and we thought this is pretty cool. It's going to be kind of fun. But we had no idea where, once we knew we were going to Vietnam, we didn't know much about Vietnam. We had to find it on a map. We, of course, didn't have any training in Vietnamese. We had some of our orientation in BBS was cultural and bicultural, having to do with learning tolerance of other people's behaviors and culture and values and so forth, mm-hmm. so that was helpful. It wasn't until almost time we were ready to go that we realized we were going to some place called Vietnam.
What was your first impression when you landed in Saigon?
We landed at night. Other than the wee small hours, it was dark. I think when we stepped off the plane, it was miserably hot and humid. It just hit us like a, like a blast from a furnace. Mm-hmm. That left an impression just getting off the plane and feeling that hot air after being for 18 hours in an air-conditioned airplane.
Note to further recruits.
Yeah, right.
Send them in an open cockpit.
Yeah, right. It's right. Gradual. Well, we stopped in Hong Kong. We stopped in Tokyo. So we had a little bit. That was, they told us this would give us a little bit oriented to the Orient on the way, but it wasn't quite like Saigon. Mm-hmm.
And you were met at the airport by Don Lutz?
No, I don't think so. I think we were met there by, who was it? Burl Lanier, but there was somebody else who died recently. And if I heard the name, I remember. I don't remember that Don was right there at the airplane. I think it was one of the directors in the area. Shoot, I can't remember his name, I think it was somebody else. Other than Don.
And you went to IBS house near the airport?
Then we went to the IBS house right near the airport, and we stayed there for several days, maybe a week or something, until we were assigned then to a little town of Rockshaw.
Yeah, so that's R-A-C-H-G-I-A.
G-I-A, uh-huh. Yeah.
And you were, I was mentioning Catherine, that was one heck of a little experience.
It was an interesting
there.
Little town. Yeah, it was on the Gulf of Thailand, uh-huh. and they had had very little exposure to Americans, uh-huh. particularly American women, and the children were fascinated with the hair on their arms, particularly Kathy, because they, the Vietnamese don't have as much hair, and they just couldn't understand why they'd have as much hair. That was one thing that impressed them. And then we stayed with an IBS member, fellow team member who was in the agriculture part, and his interpreter, and then taught us. We studied in the morning and memorized, and in the afternoons went out and practiced it on the market. So we were pretty much on our own. It wasn't a real formal classes in Vietnamese. Uh-huh. Never had. training in Vietnam prior to that time.
Did you feel that you needed a lot more training by the time you got your assignment?
Oh, yeah. I wish we, you know, it would have been nice to have a little more training. But we got, you know, we had a basis that we could at least, you know, get along on the streets and in the shops with what we had there. And then we studied the whole time we were there. We had little notes on the, you know, on the walls and the, you know, cupboards and everything. We were trying to memorize and learn idioms and everything else.
And then you were assigned to middle school in Kanta?
Yeah, it was. It was kind of divided. I was more at the high school. I had seniors and junior students. I had mostly senior boys, but I had a few girls in one of my classes too. But they were upper grade students.
What was teaching them like?
Well, we had a counterpart who was Vietnamese that we kind of answered to, and we'd sit down and share and talk about, you know, methods of teaching and so forth. We met with him and the school principal from time to time just to get our notes together as to how we wanted to emphasize things. And then we also had someone from civilian from the aid program, a lady, I don't remember her name anymore, that came down to Kanta to meet with us from time to time to kind of go over teaching techniques and, and philosophy of teaching and so forth. But it was a mixed bag. I mean, it was exciting and it was challenging, but it was frustrating because we had so little to work with. We were used to teaching with all kinds of equipment, you know, in the room, and we had nothing more than just these long tables and a bare blackboard with a piece of chalk and a rag to erase it with. Maybe we had an eraser later on, but it was very bare. And just, you know.
Did you ever eventually get any textbooks?
We wrote to some places. I guess we wrote to some friends in different places, and we ended up eventually with some textbooks, but we started out with nothing, just made a list of some things and sentences and so forth. But we eventually ended up with some books that we had enough that we could pass out to the kids, and that helped a lot. Mm-hmm.
Did you do any socializing with the students?
Not too much. I think we did more socializing with the teachers. Once in a while we did things with the students. I remember one student who we'd gotten to know real well took us out on a sampan out where we probably shouldn't have gone. You know, somehow, I don't remember how the American Army found out about it, but I think we got advised not to do that anymore. But the socialization actually was in our house. We'd have come over and have, we ordered an ice cream freezer from Sears, and they came, and we taught them how to make homemade ice cream, and we taught them how to play ping pong. And we had some games, Monopoly, various games like that. And so we did socialize there, but it was really in the context of the teaching. We started what was called an English club, and so the socializing was really kind of mixed in with our purpose of being there, which was to find as many different creative ways to make English teaching fun besides just the academic. So we had an organization, we had a president of the English club, and they would meet at our house, and sometimes we'd teach some old camp songs, and then other times just sit and talk and play and be informal. But it was a formal time, but in kind of a context of learning English at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What were your relationships like with the other Americans in the town?
Well, let's see, probably the couple we were closest to was a missionary couple that really helped us locate a house and helped us with various things. They spoke Vietnamese really well, and they didn't go out and buy things for us, but they told us places we could go. They told us where we could find an American-style toilet, which we hauled in on a Seclo and plunked in the hole in our upstairs. And they just kind of told us about the culture and kind of was there for us. For various things, just as a support.
There's an American doctor.
Yeah, there were two American doctors there, two surgeons. One of them, particularly the family, we got to know and did a lot of things socially with. The other one, not quite as much. Yeah, there were two American surgeons, the missionaries, and there were some other couples that were they were in some construction group of some kind, another couple. Mm-hmm. And then we did socialize some with some of the military officers. Got to know them because sometimes Kathy played the little organ at the compound worship service or the chapel service, they called it. So we got to know some of them. And we had a fairly good relationship with some of the officers.
What did the officers think of you guys?
Well, that was kind of a mixed bag. I think I told you that situation on the helicopter where that colonel was talking with us.
Tell me about it.
We were hitchhiking on a Huey over across the river to our town. You know, they had been repairing it, and they just wanted to take it up and make sure it was running okay, and we were desperate to get home, so we said, sure, we'll take anything. We just want to get home. So as we were up there flying across the river, the colonel asked us what we were doing, and we described that, and in the process, then his response was something to the effect that he thought if there were more people like us in this country doing what we were doing and less what they were doing, maybe this place would be better off.
Okay, so he was a colonel.
He was a colonel.
And he was in Kuntah, and this was in March of 1963. Well, I'll have to check my dates, but it is marginally possible that that was John Paul Vann. Does that name mean anything to you? That'd be very interesting.
No, I have no idea what his name was.
Because he took a liking to IVS personnel.
Right?
Don Cohen, who lives in Muir Beach, he used to come to Vung Tau and have dinner with him.
Oh, is that right?
And, you know, just he'd pass through and he'd look him up and take him out to dinner and talk to him. He said, you guys actually live out in the countryside and you're closer to the Vietnamese people than most. And he loved to kind of bounce ideas off them. But it was, he was a very strange bird. Neil Sheehan has written a rather odd biography.
Oh, is that right?
Of him that became a bestseller called Bright and Shining Lie. And it would be, I don't know if he held the rank of colonel then. I think he did. And that would have been very interesting. It's kind of something, you may have been the first IVS person he said that to. But I wouldn't be surprised if it pops up again.
That would be interesting if that turned out to be who it was. I just have no idea.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, that
but
was
others,
one side of it.
That was one side of it.
Yeah. One incident that we particularly remember, we like to tell the story a lot, it was we were playing cards. We had the doctor and his wife and another doctor and some civilian people and the military officer. And we were all just kind of talking around the table about all things we were doing. And after I described what we were doing, I could see that he was not dealing with it very well. And his face got red, and he started pounding on the table, and he said, what the hell did you say you guys were doing here? I thought, ooh. And I just went through it again, and then we went on to something else, but I could sense that that was, he was very opposed to what we were doing there.
Opposed to Americans teaching English as a second language?
Yeah, I don't know whether it was the conscious objector part that
well,
he didn't like.
That was
I
my
think
next
that was
question.
Probably part of it.
Did you ever catch any more overt flack?
Not really, but you know, there's various times it was a very strange experience for us, as particularly for me, I guess, as a male, as a conscience objector, living in a in Vietnam, in a country whose entire system, economic and social and otherwise, was based on war, and so that was always a conflict that I had to deal with, and so it was helpful when we got talking to other of our own peers in IBS that. Mm-hmm. To share some of the feelings of what it was like to be in a country where everything was based on the intensity and the value system of the war, where we were there for something entirely different. So there were sometimes when we just chose it would be easier just not say anything, but there were times when we were intrigued and tried to get into conversations with others that we thought would be receptive and took advantage of it when we could.
There were a lot of things happened while you were in Vietnam. Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated. You weren't actually in town. You were out of the country when it.
We were out of the country. We were traveling. When it happened, we came back, and then went through Saigon just a couple of days afterwards. And that was very interesting, just seeing the fresh results of the buildings being bombed and so forth. And we went on down to our home then after that, and there's where we had some interesting comments from the students because their president was not very well liked. And they didn't, they literally told us that they were glad that he was killed, and then when Kennedy was assassinated in November, December, he was a hero, and so they were telling us, you know, we were so sad to hear about your president, and we were so glad to hear about our president. Dying.
Did you ever gather why they didn't like the Diem regime?
I think a lot of it because he was Catholic, and most of our students were Buddhists, and a lot of it was this Catholic-Buddhist conflict that was there all the time. There may have been other things that I no longer can remember, but he just wasn't one that listened to the common people, that he was more of a bureaucrat and aristocrat and so forth, and the students resented that.
The students being common people.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
That's what I said.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes, that disease affects students everywhere.
Well, I think they compared that to Kennedy, who they saw was a people's person, and he was able to somehow, even in that country.
Well, rhetorically, certainly. Yes, although there's a whole new twist now to ask not what your country could do for you. It's like, I believe that, and look where it got me.
Yeah.
Although, on the other hand, there were some positive results.
Yeah.
So, something I didn't ask Catherine, there was at least one summer break while you were teaching, and there usually a summer project. Did you engage in a summer project with Vietnamese students? Did you?
I don't remember that we did. I think the only project that we did was when we first arrived before we started teaching school. We were assigned to the local hospital there, and we helped with the doctors and just opening up packages of medical supplies that came in and positioning some of these were civilian, what do you call them, civilian militia that were injured during some of the skirmishes around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were positioning them on a big table for x-rays.
Mm-hmm.
And helping to clean surgical equipment, things like that. It was fascinating.
What did you think of the war when you got there and your first few months there? I mean, it seemed at that time, you know, it's such a low level, it's a low intensity thing then.
You mean politically? Or
Well, emotionally, politically, anyway.
Emotionally, I think we kind of tried to separate ourselves from it. We saw our mission as being almost opposite of the war, and I think we were trying to put our energies in a way and project ourselves in discussions with other people that we were not part of the war, and at times I think we felt safe in saying that in some cases we opposed the war and we opposed some of the value system along with it. We were aware that it was, for all intents and purposes, a civil war, but we hadn't really formed, I think, at that time, our thoughts about whether it was okay or not okay to be involved in a civil war. We thought, you know, roughly that if it's a civil war, it was their problem. But I remember some feedback from Vietnamese asking us, you know, and they said, well, we wouldn't survive without your military and stuff here. So we heard both sides. We felt that the students and the teachers, of course, were very careful not to get into that with us. They were fearful, and they learned not to even talk, get involved in political discussions. So it wasn't that often. I don't know, just a few times when I remember talking with some Vietnamese, maybe a business person or something that wasn't quite so careful and concerned, that wanted our feedback about the American war effort.
So how did you see yourself? I mean, yes, there's a civil war going on, but what am I doing?
Well, we were just focused on the teaching. We were there to do our job.
Uh-huh.
And there was a war going on out there.
Uh-huh.
We make observations things we would read and hear and send them home. But we really kept pretty focused on what we were doing and really kind of let the war go on its own.
Uh-huh.
We could tape the war a couple of times. Uh-huh. We went on our balcony one night and felt things going around us and felt the landmines. We put our little Sony tape recorder microphone out there, and we picked up all kinds of various things that had to do with the war one night. Quickly, it was just real close. But yeah, we generally tried to separate from it.
Mm-hmm. Did you do much? I know you went to Hue later, towards the very end. But
yeah, I did.
I noticed some pictures of Dalat. Did you go to a Christmas at Dalat?
We went to Dalat twice.
Uh huh.
Yeah, we were in Dalat. Both Christmases we were there.
And 63 and 64.
63 and 64. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was interesting because Dalat, of course, was kind of a neutral ground for both sides of the conflict. We knew that there was unwritten feelings that even the Viet Cong and the Americans could be there in their own little spaces and not be in conflict with each other, because that was the R&R place.
Mm-hmm.
And so we and IBS had there was an IBS house in Dalat, and we had our little space there. But we went hiking in the mountains. It was just pine trees and beautiful mountains, just like in the High Sierras here.
Mm-hmm.
And we could hardly, it's hard to imagine. We remember comedy. Gee, here we are hiking in these mountains, and there's a war going on all around us. This is pretty incredible. So Dalat was kind of a neutral place.
Do you remember if the IVS house in Dalat
backed onto the property of Madame New?
Yes, that was the big discussion. Madame New was the next lot over.
In the last time, did anyone ever talk about Madame New attending the Christmas barbecue?
No, I remember people talking about her, people that had talked with her some. It may have been the year before, but
yes,
she was there before.
The year before.
We were there, I think so.
Yeah, because I'm trying to get down to the entomology of barbecued Buddhists.
Oh.
Because she came
she
to the IBS.
She did talk about the word barbecue.
Right,
yeah.
And she tried to eat. She noticed that
yeah.
if she would grab the food off with her hand, it would get dirty.
Mm.
And she had her assistants remove her gloves.
Oh.
She froze her gloves. So she could do the barbecue thing. So she took it very
yeah.
seriously.
Yeah.
She tried to see it as an American cultural thing.
Yeah.
And then under pressure, you know, she said, what does
yeah.
it matter, a few barbecued Buddhists?
Yeah.
And it's become this, you know, enormous
that's right.
phrase.
That's
and
right.
I'm holding IBS totally responsible
yeah, that's
for
probably
it.
Probably
yeah,
true.
It may not be, but it would be
yeah.
an interesting sideline.
Yeah.
How did you get along with other IBS personnel? How often did you encounter other IBS personnel?
We were with a couple of agriculture IBS people in our town fairly frequently, almost, you know, a couple of times a week, socializing. And then we had our seminars in Saigon every month or 6 weeks, maybe every 2 months, I can't remember how often, but that's where we look forward to socializing with all the other IBSers and
mm-hmm.
sharing our experiences. I think once in a while we were able to get off to a town or two where there were some friends that we'd gotten to know in IBS, so we just spent the weekend with them or something like that. I don't remember that too often, but it seemed like we did that maybe a few times. When we were in Saigon, of course, that was nice because we could get hot showers, because they had regular hot showers that weren't based on solar heating in the crude fashion that we had in
mm-hmm.
our place.
Tanks on the roof that just
50
passively
gallon
get
oil
hot.
Drum that we cleaned
right.
out and painted black, and when
uh-huh.
the sun was hot, we had a lukewarm shower.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was very crude.
And the delights of Saigon in those days?
Oh, we look forward to Saigon because we look forward to going out to some of the French restaurants and good eating, and there was one called the Floating Restaurant in Saigon Harbor that we understand was blown up later after we left,
mm-hmm.
but we enjoyed some good eating in Saigon. Even at the IBS house was good eating compared to what we had where we were. We look forward to that. Hot showers and good food.
Yes. And no fat.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Very little fat.
Very little fat
yeah.
on that diet.
No.
I lost about 15 pounds last time I was there.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. Didn't do anything different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I lost.
But I would hate to promote on tape,
yeah.
for the record, that go to Vietnam for dietary
purposes.
A friend of mine, David Collins, wrote a very beautiful poem about his mother.
Is that right? Yeah.
His mother riding back and having seen a picture of his unit. And she said, it's a tropical country. Why are you so
yeah.
pale?
Yeah.
And why are you so thin?
Yeah.
She said, and all of you have so many guns. You could hurt yourselves.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was literally.
Wow.
So yes, you don't think of being, in any event, you were there almost 2 years, but you're work, and or at least Catherine's work, was cut short.
I was there
yeah.
just about 2 years. She was cut short about a month. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin crisis, that was a time when they identified all the women who were in volunteer capacity, no matter what,
mm-hmm.
whether we were in a contract or not, were considered for their purposes as dependents.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the dependents were flown to Hong Kong. She had, I don't know, a day, 24 hours, to let her students know she was leaving. And she wasn't able to finish her. We were just getting ready to finish, to start setting up our final exams for the students for the year.
That was March of 65.
That was, yeah, well.
See, that's what I'm trying to.
January, February, it's probably February. The Tet Offensive was in February. And I think the Gulf of Tonkin.
Oh, the Gulf of Tonkin was in August
was
of 64.
Okay, well, it was aftermath of the Gulf of Tonkin. After
I think
that,
so.
That was
there was the escalation
yeah.
of the war. And
the Gulf of Tonkin yeah. created the excuse for
that's
the escalation
right.
politically.
Yes, and after the escalation led to the
yeah.
I think the dependents were cleared out in, I thought it was something like February of 65.
I think it was February, because
be
our contracts were supposed to be up in March, and there
right.
was a month that she went beforehand, so
right.
she just lost a month, but it was traumatic for
mm-hmm.
her and me. And for the students, they didn't understand why we had to leave. And
mm-hmm.
we just had to say, you know, American wives have to go. And that was it. So I finished my exams. And that's when I hopped a plane and flew to Saigon and then went over to Nha Trang and got on a taxi and went clear on up to Wave by myself, just for some adventure, because I figured I wouldn't see this area again for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And so my Vietnamese was good enough where I felt confident enough I could do that. So I was just my own little self up there and running around and taking some pictures and some things. And then came back and packed up and, well, there was one other little episode. Well, I don't know if you met Al Burlett yet or not. He was an agriculture fellow in our town. We both had Harley Davidson motorcycles. Both were IBS issue. Mine was a three-wheeler. His was a two-wheeler.
Uh-huh.
So we packed our motorcycles on an IBS truck and shipped them to Saigon, and we spent the night before we were ready to leave the country bar hopping on these Harley Davidson motorcycles. That was something I'll never forget.
But they were, you had to leave them behind. They were IBS.
Oh, yeah, they were IBS. We had to leave them behind, and they stayed there. But
I'd love to have a picture of an IBS or on a Harley.
Sure, we have a picture of that Harley in there somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Those little, you know, three-wheelers that the traffic people use in
uh-huh.
the cities.
Right.
And I put a couple of little cabinet handles on it so she could sit on the back and hold on to the handles as we bounced along to school.
Mm-hmm.
Some days we took our bicycles, some days we took the Seacoast if it was raining, and other days we took the Harley. And I tell people I used to drive a Harley.
And when your career with IBS finished, you went on to get an advanced degree in education. Talking about that you came to Fresno after you'd come back from Vietnam.
After we came back from Vietnam, we visited her parents and then came down from Seattle on a Greyhound bus to Fresno to pick up my car that I had since I was in high school. My sister was teaching school here. So we decided to hang around here a little bit and just see what's going on. I wanted to go to school somewhere, wasn't sure what. Since I had an education degree at the time, I thought I would go ahead and get an advanced degree in education. Then I got to talking, the education dean, after he asked me where I'd been and so forth, he said, "Oh, so you ought to meet the dean of the social work department over here. He says he's been with the United Nations and he's traveled in the same areas you've just come from." So he sent me down the hall and went down there and met with the dean of the school social work, and we got to talking and really hit it off. We just talked for a long time about Southeast Asia and the politics of the war and everything else. And he said, "Well, are you interested in getting going into social work?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know what it is. I might be." And so we talked for a while, and he gave me some material to take home and application. And the result was that they gave me some work typing there, too, so I got to know some of the teachers. And I made a decision then to go into that area. I wanted to get into counseling. I decided I wanted to get into counseling. I hadn't really thought about that much before. And I kind of was fascinated with the whole area of counseling once I talked with him and some of the other instructors that he introduced me there. So then I was accepted, and then I went into social work instead.
And did you ever use that expertise with a Southeast Asian community? Catherine has been able, of course, to extend that experience.
In the way she has, no. When we first got back, we sponsored several families from Vietnam, and we enjoyed that because we didn't have children, or maybe our children were just really young then, I guess. And we got to know several families and sponsored some and spent many hours helping them find jobs and having them at the house and entertaining and so forth. But then I guess we got more active with our own family. Then we kind of lost that, and then she ended up with her job because of her experience overseas.
Mm-hmm.
We attended a lot of the Vietnamese American Association functions for a while, but it didn't stay with that.
You mentioned that you did some kind of public speaking for IBS after you got back.
I went to several different places. I went down to the LA area and down to San Diego, and I don't know, three or four different places they paid me to give little talks about IBS and our experiences and show slides of some of our experiences in IBS. That lasted off and on for, I suppose, a year or so.
Mm-hmm. What did you show when you showed slides and you talked about the country?
one of the things that I remember one of our students, I don't know if it was Kathy's student or one of mine, but I can remember, they said, when you go back home, please try to show some beautiful things about our country and not about the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that stayed with us. And we quoted that every time we showed our pictures, so we used that as, we're here not to talk about the war. I know you have a lot of questions about the war. It'll be tempting for you not to want to, you know, for you to ask us about the war and what our thoughts are, but we would really like to give you a little different focus than what you're used to from everything else that you've read and heard and seen.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you give these talks?
A lot of them with our churches. We had so many connections throughout California with our various friends and churches. A lot of them were churches. Some of those branched off then by word of mouth to some service clubs through my parents and friends and so forth. So it was mostly, I think we gave, it seemed like we counted one time 18 or 20 different presentations on the end, but mostly the churches and some service clubs. Some private groups of friends too, I think, is our reason.
In 1975, when the war came to an end, what were your reactions to that?
Oh, I think we started having a lot of flashbacks because it was so, that was Nixon's time there, and I think we were aware that there was some misrepresentation of what was really going on. And in order to end the war, he would have had to do something other than what was the original mission. They just had to bring it to an end, and I think we thought, this is interesting. I wonder how he's going to pull this off and have everybody believe it.
Well, it worked.
Yeah,
it worked. Oh, yes, everyone blames Johnson.
Yeah.
Yes, it's all Johnson's fault. Yeah. Of course, Gerald Ford was president when the war actually ended, but
yeah,
Catherine
true.
Mentioned thinking about the people that you had worked with.
Yeah, that's true. We worried about some of our teachers that we've since been advised by some of our former students that were probably killed, you know, during the process of the war. So we were saddened because we didn't really keep that much in touch with a lot of our teachers and our friends at the time. I think it was partly there may have been censorship of the mail, but I think they were just afraid to keep in touch with us once the war's over, because we didn't quote win, that they felt like they had to be pretty careful. We did manage to keep in touch with several students, and ones that we'd helped through the American Field Service to come here for their high school senior year. They finished and went back to Vietnam, and they had enough, you know, taste of American culture that they wanted to come back again. And so someone came back to the States again, and one particular fellow that I may have talked to you earlier about. In fact, he was a 17-year-old kid at the time. He was the president of our English club. He was a sharp kid, had about a large family. And 3 or 4 years after we were home from Vietnam, he settled someplace in Canada and then came to see us in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
And then we lost track of him for 25 years. And then somehow he found us again and got in touch with us. And just 2 summers ago, we had a visit with him and his
mm-hmm.
wife, and 2 daughters came to visit us.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought out all this stuff here. In fact, that's the last time we looked at this.
Mm-hmm.
Had a newspaper from a local newspaper came and took pictures of us and so forth.
No.
That was very strange. You know, mm-hmm. he was a student then, and now he was saying how interesting it is, and now we can almost be peers. You're Phil and Kathy, whereas before you were Mr. and Mrs. Walker. And that was very remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And he holds us in extreme high esteem, and essentially says that we're responsible for his being where he is today. And so that, in a sense, for us was a tribute to IVS, that we had some stake in his future like that. And then we were friends of the parents of another student, a couple students. There were, one of them was my student and the sister was Kathy's student. He was in the Internal Revenue Service business in our little town, and we'd gotten to know him through the students. And we'd play tennis a couple times a week all the time, so we were real close friends. And they'd come over to the house and we'd teach them how to play Monopoly. His English was quite good. And so we'd play Monopoly sometimes in English and sometimes in Vietnamese, and we kept in touch with him for a while after we came back. In fact, he came to San Francisco and something to do with his business, and we met him and spent the day running around San Francisco with him.
Mm-hmm.
And his 2 daughters are now, he's back in Vietnam, and his two daughters live in the States and married American men. Mm-hmm. One of the daughters went back to Vietnam after going through a divorce, got some work with a newspaper, communist newspaper, and we hadn't kept touch with her, but the other daughter is back east now, or Florida now, I think. And so we're in touch with him and with her, and she told us how to reach her father again. We tried a phone call just not too long ago and weren't able to get through, so we just are in the process of wanting to reestablish contact with that family. You know, just haven't done it.
And have you been able to keep in touch with IBS since?
Yeah, we've seen Don Luce a couple of times at a couple of things. We had one big IBS kind of a reunion get-together down in Southern California many years back. June Cochini helped set that up. And I think we saw Don then, and a number of IBSs that we knew at the time and over there. Other than that, we really haven't kept up with the IBS. We would have loved to go to some of the other things back east, you know, but it just wasn't really practical for us to do so. So it's been limited in terms of our contract with IBS since then. We've tried to be faithful alumni, and we've sent some checks of support from time to time.
Do you know anything about the recent changes in leadership or direction?
We just knew that Don was co-leading IBS for a while, and that he changed and moved on to other things. So we kind of, that's the last I remember particularly.
I just have this feeling that there are lots of interesting stories that we haven't got to.
Well,
really
oh, yeah.
Fascinating ones, yeah. Let's see. You went for a ride on a boat on the river that you shouldn't have gone.
Yeah, that was something we shouldn't have done. We were advised not to do that. We usually ride our bicycles out to the airport, to the compound, which is about a mile and a half away from where we were and where we lived, and we'd go out there on Friday nights to a movie. Once in a while, we'd even eat at the dining hall. And we were getting on our bikes about 10 o'clock at night one night, and a couple of officers came over and politely told us not to ride home, and they put us on top of an armed personnel carrier with a submachine gun on it and took us home. And waited till we got upstairs and turned on the light and we were safe at home. That was it. They didn't say a thing. We just knew something was going on and that was mysterious and we were glad to be home. When we first moved into the process of moving into where we were living, it was a Ben Simoy. It was called a new bus station. It was an area that was a little out away from the main part of town, and this is the place that we had found, and I don't remember now whether the missionaries found it for us or some IBS people helped us find it, just for it, but it was a little ways out, and a lot of our teachers were saying, maybe you better not live that far out, the VC could, or closer out there, or you wouldn't be as safe or something, and we appreciated they were very concerned about our health and safety and welfare. They were very protective of us, students and teachers, both, but we felt safe out there. That's where we stayed.
Did any Vietnamese ever come up and tell you, say, well, like, tonight isn't a good night to go out?
No, I can't think of anything quite like that. Our missionary friends seemed to know more of what was going on, and they would tell us of things going on around. One time, I think those were IBSers that were there before we were, in fact, and told us, said that, you'll just have to know that the VC know where you live. They have maps of all the Americans, and they know where you are. Just want you to know that. I think those were IBSers that told us that. Mm-hmm. So we thought, okay, we'll be careful, and we were advised, of course, not to go into bars or into places where there'd be a lot of Americans congregating. The only time we did do anything like that was when we went out to the compound of the movies, and for some reason, I guess we felt pretty safe out there. But we were told not to. Drive out in the countryside, and so we didn't do that. I took a couple of rides, you know, 8 or 10 miles out with Harold Collins, the missionary that lived next door. He seemed to know where it was safe to go and where it was not safe. Harold Collins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were Canadians with the Christian Missionary Alliance. So he seemed to have a pretty good pulse on where it was safe, and he's the one that would advise us of as to things that are going on militarily around the place. because he had more of a fascination with military stuff than we did. We were given these little old-fashioned crank field phones for a while. We were, some military person knew or found out about us there with no source of communication, so he gave us one of these crank phones, which we could call IBS if we needed to. I don't think we used it more than a couple of times. There were some military people there that were concerned about us, but not critically. They just said, you better take one of these. We have some extra ones, have one.
Did you ever have a feeling that since the Viet Cong knew who you were, knew where you lived and anything else, did you feel that your work with IBS insulated you from that? That they
from
the
community?
Insulated you from an attack, for example, that the VC might see was different. I mean, that was IBS.
I think we did think about that. Mm-hmm. I think we did feel maybe that we, that's where we had a little bit of question about whether we should be seen in the military or seen going out there. We talked about that some, as to whether it was all right for us to ride our bikes out to the military compound. But we assumed that if they knew that much about us, they'd probably know that's the only reason we were out there, and that was just for some entertainment. But yeah, I think we felt that there was some insulation because of our particular role there, that we were maybe safer than the military would have been doing some of the things we were doing.
And I'm interested in that trip to Wei. It was really something. That, you know, by yourself in a taxi cab.
Yeah, that was pretty wild.
That's fun.
Chickens and animals and everything else. My camera. Stopping and going over some of these floating bridges that the military made for, you know, for the bridges, areas that have been bombed out. Seeing some of the areas there in Hue that were significant to the history of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It was very important to me personally to see that area. Visited a couple IBS places, I think, on the way somewhere. I think we did have an establishment in Hue. Can't remember exactly on that for sure, but Nha Trang was another town that was a beautiful beach town. Yeah, some of the Nha Trang and Vung Tau. You were in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Vung Tau was good, you know, to sit out there on the beaches, and some of the beaches were just as clear, you know, just prettier than Hawaii, you know, it was gorgeous. And again, it was out there on the beaches, you could hardly imagine the country was at war.
Well, it wasn't much at war while you were there, just the big buildup occurred.
It
right
was
after
later.
You know,
it seemed like quite a bit when we were there, but we realized, of course, it was just the beginnings.
You mentioned when you sat down, this is just for fun.
Yeah.
Actually, when you sat down with that dean of the social work department, you talked about the politics of the war. What would you have talked about then after?
I really don't remember. I do remember that he was fascinated and very supportive of the reason that I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
He was with UN peacekeeping types
right.
of things, which had the same value system at IBS, and so I think that's where we hit it off very well.
Right.
He made it very clear of his opposition to the war, and I talked about our experiences, and that we generally opposed the war too. We felt that it was just another example of Americans telling some other country what to do, and we wouldn't like it if they came and told us what to do in our civil war.
But they were they would become
communists.
Yeah,
sure, they would
become
communists
be
otherwise. That was the domino theory then. That was what bought the war.
Yes. It was wrong?
Well, I think it proved it to be.
In the long run.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
At least that's what when my students ask me, I give them that answer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. I reserve the right to ask about more stories, however, in the future. Thank you very much. Yeah, we have a little story about
Kathy, you can come in.
Kathy?
Yeah.
Come on in. We have a post-interview story that has come to mind.
What story?
Well, I didn't know if you used the example that we used to tell all the time about our little cook, you know?
Oh,
that we paid her,
no,
you know,
I
we paid her. We paid $30 a month rent for our apartment. And then we found this little Vietnamese lady to do our cooking. We paid her $14 a month, and she worked for us, 6 days a week for about 10 hours
mm-hmm.
a day. She'd go out and do the shopping, and bring in our food for us in the morning, and bring in a live chicken and pluck it there in our downstairs area. But anyway, we started out with charcoal. She cooked on charcoal. And then we, through our resources, figured out that we could get a propane system set up in our little place there. So we got a propane tank and got a little thing set up there in the back on top of the charcoal stove. It's that little counter over there. So she got into cooking with the propane. She'd probably seen it before, but she'd never cooked on it before. And every once in a while, we'd run out of propane, and we couldn't get it right away. We might have to wait till the next day because it was late in the evening or something. And she would fuss and stew and say she can't fix dinner because she were out of propane.
Can't fix dinner, I don't know.
So we'd tell her in Vietnamese, she didn't speak a word of English, "You've been cooking for 35 years on this charcoal. Can't you just do it one more night? I'll promise I'll get the propane for you in the morning."
I don't know. Is this a horrible lesson in the impact of Westernization or something?
And she paid for a cook for her family.
She had enough money out of $14 a month that she could do that. This is written by a Vietnamese who's in social services here. We do some case referrals.
Oh.
She's got a master's degree in social work, but her master's degree was based on, this book was her master's degree. It's kind of a reflection of American culture coming from Vietnam and so forth.
The Shadows of Doubts and Fears, an autobiographical presentation
by a lot of
Duan T. Trong, 1995. Great.
She's written a number of letters to the editor in the local paper, and just a very sharp, articulate lady.
Oh, this is very nice.
You know, it's kind of interesting to read her perspective of American culture.
Are these for sale somewhere?
I could probably get another one for you.
I would very much like a copy of that.
Okay.
Because
I want to
increase the segment that I deal with Vietnamese in the United States, because they're visible enough now that my students see it as more than just a problem. It's a new part of the new face of America. It's different.
Okay. I don't see an answer to this, but I see her periodically, so I'll just tell her that what our experience here was, and she'd be fascinated with that anyway.
Yeah. Oh.
And I'm sure she'd be happy to get me another one.
That'd be great. And I'll try to get a copy of Robert Olin Butler's Good Scent from a Strange Mountain.
Which is a so-called
fictional account of what it's like to be Vietnamese in the United States, of course told by an American who's an intelligence officer in Vietnam.
Mm.
He won the, National Book Award or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or Pulitzer or something big.
Mm.
Oh.
And he lives in Baton Rouge.
Is that right?
Wow.
You know,
Very
Henry Cabot Lodge was the ambassador to Vietnam when we first arrived, I think. And was it when we got back from Vietnam or before we went to Vietnam? We were walking around Washington, D.C., and we met his son on the street and
talked a little about it.
But I can't remember if that was before or after. I think it was before we went to Vietnam. We were just getting ready to go.
That's
and we were shopping.
Before,
you know,
ran into his son.
That reminds me, how would you recognize him as Henry Cabot Lodge's son?
We were with somebody that
recognized
said, "That's Henry Cabot Lodge's son."
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we said, "Oh, really?" And we just had a quick greeting, I think.
Boy, that's fascinating. Robert, that thing with the banner, the photograph of Robert McNamara and General Khan coming to, where was that? Was that in Kantaa?
That was in Kantaa.
Yeah.
What was that airplane that came in? School, it was a holiday, you know,
school
kids were let out
and
issued a little.
They were given American flags. And
we have a slide of real close up. I mean, I was able to walk right up next to him there with General
Cow
and McNamara and the Secretary of Defense, Robert Taylor, all in the same picture, I think. And that was a historic slide that I took there. I don't know if that's in any of these or not.
No, I just wondered whether that meant anything. School was let out. It was. Did any of the students ever talk about it after?
We didn't think that they understood exactly, just that it was an important American official that they were supposed to greet.
Anything had to do with something to do with America meant a lot to them. It was big stuff. It just was fun. Plus, it was a school holiday. That was great, too.
Yeah.
You were over there in Vietnam with the Air Force.
No, not at all. No, I just visited it.
You visited? Oh, okay. You mentioned something about Air Force earlier.
No. Okay. Well, thank you very much.